some of the top executives at the largest media companies in the country participated in that endeavor to implement the Powell memo. We unearthed a letter from CBS's president at the time saying not only did he agree with the Powell memo's directives and ideology, but that he was working to correct the situation at CBS News. That's a direct quote. And so I think we have to look at what's gone on in with media consolidation.
We have 30 seconds, David.
With Donald Trump essentially saying media mergers are predicated on his political ideology, we have to look at that as the culmination of the government trying to pressure and successfully pressuring media companies to do its bidding.
We want to thank you so much, David, for being with us. David Sirota, founder and editor-in-chief of The Lever, speaking to us from Denver, Colorado, co-author of Master Plan, The Hidden Plot to Legalize Corruption in America. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Marie, A Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in, and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial, and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the fire at Portland City Councilor Candace Avalos' house was not likely to be arson, officials say. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield joins a multi-state lawsuit to keep SNAP benefits coming. And a nonprofit tracking pregnant people detained by ICE raises alarm about their treatment. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 28, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Fire officials say the fire that burned part of Portland City Councilor Avalos' house and car was not likely an arson, but they haven't ruled it out. Investigators say they haven't found any accelerants or devices designed to start fires that would suggest the fire was set on purpose. That would include things like gasoline or lighter fluid. Investigators say the fires didn't start at her house or in her car either, but more likely in a neighbor's shed. Avalos wrote on social media that she escaped with her cat, Valentino, and she's been supported by friends in the meantime. Community members and elected leaders worried the fire could be politically motivated because Avalos has been the subject of serious right-wing hate online. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield is suing the U.S. Department of Agriculture for illegally suspending SNAP benefits. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is set to run out of money by Saturday because of the government shutdown. SNAP helps 42 million Americans buy food, including one in six Oregonians. Advocates and now 22 attorneys general, including Oregon's, are pointing out that the USDA has special SNAP contingency funds that it could spend. The lawsuit says that the USDA has funded other programs with emergency funds, but not SNAP. It says the Trump administration has violated the Administrative Procedure Act because states are responsible for administering the programs. The group of attorneys general also plans to file a temporary restraining order to ensure benefits can flow after this weekend. Rayfield said in a statement, quote, "This isn't complicated. People need to eat. If these benefits stop, thousands of Oregonians will be left wondering how to put food on the table. The USDA has the authority and the money to keep SNAP running, and refusing to do so is both illegal and deeply cruel," end quote. While congressional Republicans control both chambers of Congress, they need 60 votes to pass the spending bill and end the government shutdown, which must include some Democratic representatives. Documents from the Department of Housing and Urban Development detail the Trump administration's plans to slash funding for permanent housing that largely benefits families with children and who were previously homeless. Experts say the change could force over 200,000 out of their homes. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
The Trump administration plans to make significant cuts to permanent housing supports, which largely benefit families with children and those who have experienced homelessness in the past. The change would cut two-thirds of funding from the Continuum of Care program, according to Department of Housing and Urban Development documents obtained by Politico. Allison Eisinger, executive director of the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness, says 3,500 households in King County are at risk of losing their homes because of these cuts.
What is going to happen across this country is a nightmare, but it is a nightmare that doesn't have to be this way. It is being perpetrated by our federal government on us. And it just breaks my heart.
Cuts to the Continuum of Care and emergency housing voucher programs would risk forcing over 275,000 people across the country out of their housing, according to the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Based on the last count, homelessness has increased by about 9% in Washington since 2022, up to nearly 160,000 people. Proponents of the move say cutting funding for permanent housing is intended to promote self-sufficiency. Eisinger says that idea does not reflect reality.
What happens to somebody who's disabled and living on $804 a month? Unless they're fortunate enough to have a friend or family member whom they can stay with, those people are going to be out on the streets.
Eisinger adds that even for people who are able to work, rent exceeds what many of them can afford. Research shows that for every $100 increase in rent in a city, there is at least a 9% corresponding increase in the number of people who experience homelessness. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will vote today on whether to rehear the case for a temporary restraining order to keep National Guard troops out of Portland. A three-judge panel ruled that deployment was okay, but that decision could be revisited. All 29 judges on the Court of Appeals must vote on whether to hear the case, something that's relatively rare. If they decide to take it, it will be heard by 11 judges, 10 selected at random, and the Chief Justice. The state of Oregon and the federal government are prepping a separate three-day trial at the district court level set to start Wednesday. That's the original case filed by Oregon, Portland, and the state of California seeking to stop National Guard deployment in Portland, finally getting a full trial on the merits. If the Ninth Circuit takes up the case, however, that trial will be likely on hold. The result of the vote from the Ninth Circuit should be public by 5 p.m. A global nonprofit has launched a detention pregnancy tracker to gather real-time data on pregnant, postpartum, and nursing women detained by ICE in Illinois and nationwide. Amid reports, the agency is violating its own policy that limits such detentions. Commission staff say the government's lack of transparency has forced them to interview deported women abroad, revealing alarming accounts of miscarriages, malnutrition, and inadequate care in the U.S. detention facilities. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
As Illinois continues to be the target of aggressive federal immigration operations, among reports of more than 1,000 people being arrested so far, limited information has been shared about ICE detainees who are pregnant. A nonprofit group that helps women in crisis is working to change that. The Women's Refugee Commission created the Detention Pregnancy Tracker to collect real-time information about pregnant, postpartum, and nursing women detained by ICE. A current policy restricts the agency from arresting immigrants who are pregnant or postpartum, except in extraordinary circumstances. But Melanie Nezer with the commission says ongoing reports indicate the policy isn't being followed.
We have learned that women are miscarrying in detention, that women are not getting the nutrition that they need for healthy pregnancies, and that they are showing up after being deported malnourished. So that's a huge concern.
ICE officials have said pregnant women are housed in facilities to receive proper care while in custody, but despite filing Freedom of Information Act requests, Nezer says the agency hasn't shared the data her group is asking for, so they're working with healthcare providers and lawyers to collect information and urging anyone with knowledge about pregnant people in detention to submit reports online at detentionpregnancytracker.com. Nezer says commission staff had to travel to Mexico and Central America to speak with women who had recently been deported to learn more about the conditions they're facing in U.S. detention. She says it's bad enough to be detained during pregnancy and is especially concerned about the government's lack of transparency about their treatment.
We have a right to know how women are being treated in this country, if there are abuses, if there are harms. We need to know that so we can start to fix the problem, because I would assume that everybody of good faith and good conscience would want pregnant women to get the care they need to have healthy babies.
Nezer says they are still in the early stages of collecting and analyzing data and are working to obtain consent from the people affected to share their stories. She says they are advocating to end the detention of anyone who is pregnant or nursing, or at least to see that they receive the proper care.
It's really kind of horrifying to think that women are miscarrying in immigration detention alone without any care. That should not be happening in our country.
For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Portlanders are seeing only one major ballot issue this time around. It's not a candidate for office. The question is, should and will Portlanders pay higher taxes to keep the city's Parks Department operating? There is significant complexity behind this ballot measure, 26260, which is a proposal to renew and increase the city's parks levy. And there's a lot at stake. The annual operating budget for the city's Parks Bureau is around $168 million. About half comes from the city's general fund, which also pays for police, homeless services, and other programs. It is discretionary, meaning there is some wiggle room in how it can be spent. The other half comes from the parks levy. That levy, first approved by voters in 2020, taxes property owners 80 cents per $1,000 assessed value annually. Someone who owns a house at the median value for Multnomah County, $221,600, pays $177 per year. The median commercial property owner pays about $251 per year. That money pays for parks programming like swim lessons, summer camps, and sports programs, while allowing the Parks Bureau to offer free or reduced cost programs to low-income users. The levy also covers some maintenance work, including trash pickup and tree planting. The levy cannot pay for major maintenance projects like replacing a community center roof or repairing a playground. The November ballot measure increases the current levy taxing rate from 80 cents to $1.40. That nearly 75% increase would raise an estimated $84 million in the first year. But this newer levy mostly pays for parks programming and classes, with only 2% going to major maintenance. If the measure fails, the city estimates the Parks Bureau will lose nearly half its annual operating budget. That would lead to its laying off of about half of the Bureau's staff and shutting down a significant fraction of parks programming, youth classes, and other activities. Nearly all members of Portland City Council back the measure, as does the mayor. Local environmental organizations, groups that advocate for communities of color, public labor unions, and neighborhood groups have also signed on. The measure has backing from the Portland Metro Chamber, despite the group's support of a moratorium on new and increased taxes. Portland voters have until 8 p.m. Tuesday, November 4th, to drop their ballots off at an official election site. Mailed ballots must be postmarked by the same date. More legislatures convene special sessions for mid-decade redistricting. States prepare emergency food assistance funds. And lawmakers consider bills to prevent invasion by other states' National Guard troops. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks. We're following our democracy in historic times.
What we have seen today is the worst kind of political backtrack, an attempt to grab power by erasing the voter's voice.
Campaigning for governor, Virginia's Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears is condemning Democrats for convening a special legislative session to change the state's constitution and let them redraw congressional maps. A mid-decade redistricting arms race started with Texas Republicans acting at the request of President Donald Trump, but has now spread to at least six states. Indiana's Republican governor is calling the legislature into a special session starting November 3rd. That's one day before California voters decide whether to change their congressional lines, which could benefit Democrats in next year's midterms. Similar efforts are underway in Illinois, where Democratic congressional leaders are meeting with legislators. New York, Missouri, and North Carolina may follow suit. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson says he's negotiating across the aisle on a proposal to pay all federal workers while the government is shut down. Republicans have backed a measure to pay those who are working without pay. Democrats say they want even furloughed staff getting paychecks to keep the White House from getting to decide which employees are crucial enough to get paid. Johnson says his plan may bridge the gap. Meanwhile, states are preparing for a lapse in federal food assistance. The Department of Agriculture says SNAP benefits will not go out on November 1st, meaning more than 40 million low-income people could go hungry. Minnesota's Democratic Governor Tim Walz says the state has an emergency assistance fund, but if the shutdown continues, that could quickly dry up.
We go ahead and give it. We have to be very cautious about once we spend it, there's no reimbursement coming back from the federal government, because our responsibility to balance the budget and be accountable for that.
States may also struggle to fund low-income heating assistance, and unless the deadlocked Congress can act, consumers who get health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges may face sticker shock, with open enrollment starting and pandemic-era subsidies expiring. Separately, an estimated 9 million people each year go without prescriptions because of their cost, while seniors and others on fixed incomes report rationing their medicines. Drug company Pfizer is partnering with the White House to create Trump RX, a lower-cost direct-to-consumer service. Though it doesn't debut until 2026, businessman and TV celebrity Mark Cuban is praising what it will do.
Our brand drugs are more expensive because PBMs are involved. With Trump RX and the MFN program, that allows manufacturers to work around the PBMs and work directly to patients.
A direct-to-consumer prescription company Cuban started will work with Trump RX, but experts are skeptical if the partnership can beat existing discounts from private or public insurance or bring prices down enough to help people without insurance. States like Washington and New York are taking action to protect themselves from Trump's National Guard deployments. Though the administration claims the troops reduce crime and help ICE with mass arrests, critics say they're also being used to stop peaceful political protests. New York State Senator Andrew Gonardes says lawmakers are considering a bill to protect the state's sovereignty.
If a Republican state sends their troops and invades New York at the president's request, we would have recourse in our own state courts to bring suit against that state to stop them.
Gonardes says the Posse Comitatus Act also prohibits using any federal armed forces for law enforcement in New York or any other state. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a vaccine pledge signed by the Multnomah County Public Health Director and 23 other big city health departments. Then, KBOO's Dave Johnson speaks with the organizers of the Portland Underground Grad School's new course in Shri Allyship. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and clear with a high of 59 degrees. Today in history, in 1914, American virologist Jonas Salk was born. Salk developed the first successful vaccines against polio. The quote of the day is from Salk, who said, quote, "Neither wisdom nor goodwill is now dominant. Hope lies in dreams, in imagination, and in the courage of those who dare to make dreams into reality." The Vatican will return indigenous artifacts it took from Canada a century ago, and communities are preparing for their return. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been 100 years, but the Vatican is now expected to return Indigenous artifacts to Canada. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, Indigenous communities are preparing for the return of the sacred items.
The museum in the Vatican City has held the artifacts since 1925, but in a few weeks, an announcement is expected that will see the return of dozens of artifacts that could be back in Canada by the end of the year. Indigenous communities have been calling on the Catholic Church for decades to return them. The National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Cindy Woodhouse-Nepenak, has described the artifacts as living, sacred pieces of Indigenous cultures and ceremonies and must be treated as the invaluable objects they are. Cody Grote is an assistant professor of history and Indigenous studies at Western University in Ontario.
To us, these aren't just artifacts that we're going to put behind a glass case. These are ancestors in their own right. They have their own sentience, their own being. So when we repatriate these cultural items, we have to recognize that there's ceremony associated with that. This can't just be a transfer from one box to another to an institution. These are ancestors who need to be welcomed back with ceremony and cultural protocol.
Grote says it's not exactly clear what artifacts are held by the Vatican, but an exhibit at the Vatican in 1925 also published a catalog of specific artifacts, and that's a starting point, he says, to find out what else might be in the collection. Grote also says the artifacts are expected to be transferred to the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, and that the Canadian Museum of History is expected to act as an intermediary. He also says it's important that in all points of the process, First Nations need to be part of the discussions, as he's sure there will be challenges, since the process is expected to be long and slow, but also one that is long overdue. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The play Blue Jays Canoe About Loss, Resilience, and the Power of Native Stories opens next month. Brian Bull, senior reporter for Buffalo's Fire, has this preview.
The story centers around Blue Jay, a DJ at a fictional tribal radio station in Oregon's Willamette Valley.
And good afternoon, and a good day it is indeed.
Kirby Brown plays Blue Jay, who informs and entertains his listeners through the COVID-19 pandemic and the 2020 wildfires. But Blue Jay also struggles.
One of Blue Jay's tragic flaws is that he just doesn't ask for help. When the stuff starts hitting the fan, that's when we gotta hold each other tight.
The big mystery in the play surrounds an incomplete wooden canoe Blue Jay has in storage. The reason why it's been left undone unearths a past tragedy, which has given Blue Jay survivor's guilt. Marta Lou Clifford and Teresa May co-wrote Blue Jay's Canoe. Both have specific lessons they'd like the audience to leave with.
I want them to leave with the importance of stories, the importance of family, and how they are all connected.
Indigenous stories are not artifacts. They're not myths from some time past. They carry knowledge for the present.
The storyline also weaves in traditional teachings and legends, told through a spirit person named Heron, who will eventually be key to solving the show's mystery.
Did you ever hear a story that saved your life?
Blue Jay's Canoe runs through November 23rd at the Very Little Theater in Eugene. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, and Vice Chair U.S. Senator Brian Schatz are hosting a hearing Wednesday on the impacts of the federal government shutdown and tribes. Witnesses are leaders from national Native organizations, including in areas of health and education. The hearing in Washington will also be streamed online. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Organizers of the No Kings protest say they will not be deterred from future events, despite President Donald Trump and other Republicans mocking them. And new polling suggests a majority of Americans relate favorably to the 7 million marchers who protested what they see as the U.S. moving towards an authoritarian government. Eric Tegedoff reports.
Targeted boycotts, electoral organizing, and additional street protests are on the table for the No Kings Alliance, the groups behind last weekend's anti-Trump demonstrations in North Carolina and around the country. While Republicans spent days trying to downplay the protests, an estimated 7 million people in all 50 states took to the streets calling for an end to what they described as the administration's authoritarian actions. There were more than 50 events across North Carolina as part of the No Kings protests. On a national news call to media, Indivisible co-founder Ezra Levin said groups will now work to build a nationwide rapid response network, asking supporters to take new actions each week.
No successful anti-authoritarian movement in the history of the world has relied exclusively on one-day protests. Successful movements grow, they evolve, they diversify their tactics, and they do new things together.
A just-released survey from the Public Religion Research Institute shows respondents share some of the same concerns as protesters. Asked if President Trump is a potentially dangerous dictator whose power should be limited, or a strong leader who should be given necessary power, Americans chose the dictator option by 56% to 41%, a margin that has nearly doubled since April. To mock marchers, Trump posted a video generated by AI on social media of himself wearing a crown while piloting a fighter jet, dumping feces on protesters below. Meanwhile, the federal government is shut down, and bipartisan budget talks have stalled. Lisa Gilbert with the group Public Citizen calls it the most broken budget moment in U.S. history.
Thus far, this budget battle leverage moment is being utilized by Democrats effectively to push for negotiations and an eventual deal that returns health care to regular Americans, at the very least restoring the expiring Affordable Care Act tax credits so millions more don't lose their care.
Before the 7 million people participated in last weekend's events, 5 million attended the first No Kings event in June, and 3 million turned out for the Hands Off event last April. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. attacks on boats alleged to be carrying drugs raises many legal and political questions. As one observer notes, President Trump's real aim may be regime change in Venezuela, but we cannot exclude another objective, justifying extrajudicial killings at home as well as on the high seas. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Trump administration has now conducted 10 known strikes on boats off the Venezuelan and Colombian coasts that supposedly carry drugs destined for the U.S. The administration has now amassed a veritable armada in the region, several attack boats, a nuclear-capable submarine, an aircraft carrier, strike group, a marine expeditionary unit. In all, around 10,000 soldiers and sailors are involved. It's a rather extraordinary show of force, out of proportion to the alleged problem. The unknowns in this display of force are substantial, raising questions about the administration's motives and objectives. No proof has been offered that the boats carried drugs or were headed to U.S. ports. No effort has been made to explain why Venezuela, and possibly Colombia, is being targeted for narco-terrorism when they are not conduits for fentanyl, the primary drug killer, or for cocaine. Mexico is the main route for fentanyl, and Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia are the principal coca producers. No attempts were made to stop and board the boats, as would be normal procedure. No warnings were issued to the boats, such as would probably have saved lives, 43 so far. These attacks, in short, reek of illegality, false hyping, and hidden purposes. Clearly, the attacks on the boats raise legal questions, enough to cause the resignation of Admiral Alvin Halsey, head of the U.S. Southern Command. Though he has not said so, he reportedly protested the legality of the boat attacks. But then this administration gives scant attention to lawful behavior. More relevant are Trump's executive order, which he made public to authorize CIA covert action in Venezuela, and Trump's comment that with control of the sea, quote, we are certainly looking at land now. CNN reported on October 24th, quote, Trump is considering plans to target cocaine facilities and drug trafficking routes inside Venezuela, though he has not yet made a decision on whether to move forward with them, three U.S. officials told CNN. For now, the administration is content to magnify the problem and threaten action. Nicolas Maduro is an indicted drug trafficker in the United States, and he's a fugitive of American justice, said Secretary of State Rubio. The Pentagon's press secretary says the U.S. aims to, quote, dismantle transnational criminal organizations and counter narco-terrorism. Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, is, according to Trump, an illegal drug dealer, quote unquote, and a low-rated and very unpopular leader with a fresh mouth toward America. Trump announced that the U.S. is ending all aid to Colombia and will impose new tariffs unless Colombia stops drug production. Never before has drug interdiction required the deployment of enough firepower to overrun a country. In truth, every word and action by this administration points to regime change in Venezuela and perhaps Colombia as well as its objective. Although the CNN report notes that Trump has not excluded a diplomatic approach to the Nicolas Maduro regime, the deployment of excess war-making power suggests that Trump is mainly relying on the threat to use force to bring about Maduro's departure. Trump probably wants to avoid a direct assault inside Venezuela, since that would raise some opposition in Congress and, if the U.S. were to suffer casualties, arouse public opinion. If he can squeeze Maduro enough to force his exit without an invasion, so much the better. No administration official has consulted with a Congress member to explain the administration's policy and procedures. Senator Rand Paul, who correctly describes the boat attacks as extrajudicial killings, has introduced resolutions that would require Trump to obtain authorization from Congress before attacking. But Trump insists he doesn't need authorization from Congress, even if he decides to invade. Quote, "I'm not going to necessarily ask for a declaration of war," he said. "I think we're just going to kill people that are bringing drugs into our country. Okay? We're going to kill them. You know, they're going to be like dead," unquote. Spoken like a true mafia leader. Maybe he'll notify Congress after the fact, but what if Congress isn't in session? Efforts to bring the War Powers Act into force are underway, but with virtually no chance of making it through Congress and onto Trump's desk. The War Powers Act compels consultation with Congress and a 60-day limit on military action without congressional consent to remove the limitation. When was the last time Trump sought congressional assent on any foreign policy? In his view of presidential power, Congress is largely a bystander. The president can do anything he wants. And therein lies the greatest danger from these extrajudicial killings, that they might extend to Trump's war within. Gunboat diplomacy transfers to the home front, where military forces in our cities shoot first and ask questions later. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 28, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and Dave Johnson. Our producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Judith Ruiz Branch, Isabel Charlet, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast